From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. We talked to both of Michigan senators about the firing of the FBI director. That's while he was investigating possible Trump campaign ties with Russia.
I believe enough is enough. We can't go through this erosion of trust, and ultimately that's what's happening.
The only folks winning right now are Russia, because it's exactly what they want to have happen: destabilize the United States.
There's an effort to get towns on the shores of the Great Lakes to think before they build too close to the water.
The shape of the shorelines change over time as lake levels change over time.
Arts leaders want the city of Detroit to formally encourage arts.
It's really a driver for the future of the city as it sort of reestablishes and recreates its contemporary identity.
Plus, the rise of elevator music started with a Michigan inventor.
The name Muzak, I mean, I think we sort of use that as a pejorative term.
Yes, yes we do. All of that, plus the news, like music to your ears. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Well, as you probably heard a lot today, President Donald Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. Here to talk about that are U.S. Senators Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters. Senator Stabenow, what was your reaction when you heard about this?
I was stunned. I mean, the idea after they fired Sally Yates when she raised the concerns about the National Security Advisor Flynn and his inappropriate relationships with Russia, and then now to fire the FBI director a little over a day before he was going to testify. Tomorrow he was going to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And so they fire him right before he was going to do that, and we know that they have been ramping up the investigation. So this is stunning and flies in the face of the Constitution in terms of accountability and checks and balances. The President of the United States should not be able to do that.
Senator Peters, the White House indicates Comey lost his job because of how he dealt with the investigation into Hillary Clinton's handling of classified emails. But President Trump added an odd paragraph in the letter in which he was firing James Comey. That paragraph read in part, "While I greatly appreciate you informing me on three separate occasions that I am not under investigation," and then it goes on to indicate, "you're fired." So what does that tell you about the mindset of the president?
That tells me the president is definitely thinking about the Russian investigation, and it's just simply unprecedented to have an FBI director being fired in the midst of an investigation as to the possible involvement of the Trump administration with the Russians. He is using the excuse of the Hillary emails, so my question back would be, if it was such an issue, why didn't you fire him back in January? We are now in May. Many months have passed. He is just grabbing for an excuse. It's clear that Mr. Comey was involved in the investigation. Some news reports today have come out that he actually was discussing getting additional resources for the investigation just a few days ago, and perhaps that request for additional resources, because he is following this case aggressively, as he should as an FBI director, got back to the White House, and they wanted to put a stop to it. It certainly looks as if this is an attempt to stop a serious, thoughtful investigation from going forward. And this should trouble every American. This goes to the very core of our democracy.
Just to underscore what Senator Peters said, I mean, we have in the last few days seen in the news reports on grand juries and subpoenas and ramped up investigations. And so it just doesn't pass the laugh test that somehow he had fired the FBI director because of what he did last year in the campaign related to Hillary Clinton.
Let's talk about what's next. I'd like to ask each of you, how confident are you that a new Trump-appointed FBI director will pursue the Trump campaign and Russia investigation?
I think that's a big question. I'm at this point not clear at all that someone appointed by this president could be independent. We need a special prosecutor, an independent person who will be able to call it as he or she sees it on behalf of the American people, follow wherever the evidence goes, and determine what really happened. Because we're talking about a national security issue. Russia is now using the cyber hacking to attack and undermine our very democracy.
Senator Peters, What, if anything...
I just want to add, too, it's clear that it's not just here in the United States. We saw the actions of the Russians in the French election as well. This is a concerted effort by the Russians to undermine democratic governments in Europe and other places around the world. This is a very, very serious issue for democracy, and we can't trust a political appointee to handle very sensitive investigation, which is why I agree with Senator Stabenow. We need to have a special prosecutor that's independent and with the transparency that the American people deserve.
Which brings me to my final question, and that is, I'd like both of you to answer this. What, if anything, do you think Congress can do now?
Well, the first thing that our Democratic leader has called for is a meeting with all the members of the Senate, with the Attorney General, with the deputy, independent of each other, to talk about what they did, why they did it, what was happening there, so we can hear directly from them in a closed session. But we're going to continue to speak out over and over again about a strong, independent, special prosecutor. And we need bipartisan support to make that happen. I would hope, because this isn't about Democrats and Republicans, it really isn't. This is about America. It's about our democracy. People expect us to be able to get beyond partisanship and work on behalf of our country and national security, and also holding people accountable who may think that they're above the law. And you can't just have the President of the United States, because he doesn't want to be investigated, firing people throughout the federal government, which he's begun to do.
Senator Peters, same question. What should Congress do?
Well, I'm hopeful we will be able to build the bipartisan support for getting to the bottom of this, getting the answers that everyone deserves. You know, I'm certainly encouraged by some of the comments made by my Republican Senate colleagues after the firing of Mr. Comey, that they had real concerns about that. We're seeing more of them starting to ask more questions. And ultimately, this has to be about rising above party and focusing on our country.
And by the way, the only folks winning right now are Russia, because it's exactly what they want to have happen. Destabilize the United States democracy, destabilize all the Western democracies so they can somehow recreate the Soviet Union and be able to rise to prominence in the world. That's what they want, and we've got to work together to make sure that doesn't happen.
We've been speaking with both of Michigan's U.S. Senators Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters about President Donald Trump firing FBI Director James Comey. Thanks to both of you for taking the time.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Escape rooms keep gaining popularity. You might have heard of them. It's an interactive game where you and a bunch of friends, or maybe even complete strangers, are locked in a room and have to solve a series of puzzles to get out. Oh, and you only have about an hour to do it. The scenarios are endless. Think Sherlock Holmes, Indiana Jones, Jailbreak. Patton Doyle is the co-founder of Decode Detroit, an escape room with a tech vibe located in Ann Arbor. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia stopped by to check out the game room, where the main character is an artificial intelligence named Minerva.
Minerva, will you explain to them why they're here?
The researchers here at the Minerva Project have been developing me for many years, working countless hours of overtime, all so that I can learn the intrinsic meaning behind humanity.
Minerva is an adolescent artificial intelligence who is trying to learn more about the world. Even ourselves, we're sort of learning more about Minerva as the story evolves. Definitely within the escape room here, Minerva's story is she wants to escape, and she's going to do anything to make that happen.
As soon as everyone is ready, Dr. Clark will take you back to the research annex, and we can go over the rules. I'll see you there.
Thanks, Minerva. So as a kid, I was always into lots of different puzzling things. In particular, we always did treasure hunts or letterboxing, if you're familiar with that. And so when I learned that this trend was going on without us, I said, wait a minute, we have to see if we can be a part of it. All right, so you guys ready?
Yeah.
Remember, have fun. Ready? Go.
So what if they told you about how to, like, do you even know what the puzzle is?
I have no idea. I have to figure out what this means so I can enter a four-digit code that'll turn that white. And I have no idea, because these are, like, some of them are fractions, some of them are whole numbers. But they're, maybe the pictures match. My name's Jenny Powell. I'm a marketing person, so numbers are not necessarily my thing. So,
guys, the laser is over there.
Okay. See the Detroit River on the outside edge of the ring?
Yes.
Maybe that will help you line things up.
My background is all over the map. I originally did physics at the University of Michigan, and then I went to get a master's in transportation at MIT, studying a variety of things from optimizing bus schedules to urban planning and how that works. And then I came back to Detroit in part and Southeast Michigan to be part of the resurgence of the region's urban areas.
So what are you feeling when you're going through this?
It's fun, but it's a little stressful, too. I mean, it's, you know, I don't feel as smart as I think, as I thought I would be. But, no, it's really, it's fun. It's very, it's also really clever, like the rope with the numbers. I'm not certain that I would have ever thought of something like that.
After you complete the escape room here, you go to our website and click on part two of the adventure, which is Minerva's Escape. And it's a free puzzle adventure. Currently in downtown Ann Arbor and expanding to Metro Detroit, the rest of Metro Detroit, where you have to follow a series of clues that are placed in local shops, usually locally owned shops, around the area. So the idea is to introduce people to areas of the city that they're not familiar with.
Okay.
There we go.
All right, we got station four.
All right.
Woo!
Everyone who's come through seems to really enjoy it. And what I like is that there's something for everyone. For the people who really want to sit down and do a puzzle, they can do that. And they can bring along their friend that wants to be in the middle of an adventure and just interact with Minerva, while also a group that comes in and really just wants to sit down and go to their own corner and work on puzzles can do that as well. So there's something for everyone.
And do you see any unexpected things ever?
Oh, we see plenty of unexpected things. My favorite so far was when a 7-year-old had solved a puzzle and her parents weren't listening to her. And she's sitting there holding the answer in her hands and everyone's looking around trying to figure out what else to do. So there's a lot of unexpected things. Inspiration comes from a lot of unexpected places. And in particular, the people who come through the room are generally pretty inspiring. They're clever. So kudos to them.
Minerva, do the Jeopardy scores have any significance?
I'm not normally allowed in this room. I don't know anything about it. Sorry.
Thank you.
Okay. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. In Detroit, there are all kinds of artists and art projects happening organically. But the city of Detroit really doesn't have a vehicle to encourage or develop an arts culture. One of the arts and culture leaders would like to see that changed. Anya Sirota is an assistant professor of architecture at the University of Michigan's Taubman School of Architecture. So what role do you think the city of Detroit, the government, should have in developing an arts culture in the city?
Well, it's unquestionable that art and culture is an attractor for the city, and it gives it an incredibly unique vibe. It brings interest, it brings tourism, but it also creates a sense of place that's unlike any other. It makes communities proud of their heritage, of their sense of identity, and I think it's really a driver for the future of the city as it sort of reestablishes and recreates its contemporary identity.
Well, like I said, there's a lot happening organically. I mean, there's an exciting time for a lot of artists in the city. What do you think the government, the city government, could do or should do to help develop that?
Well, so many people are working independently and individually. And very often, artists are feeling that their creative practices could be instrumentalized for economic redevelopment, for the kind of construction of the identity of place. But there are no institutions in place currently at the government level to protect the artists' interests. For example, the Detroit Culture Council, which is a very informal group of artists leading the charge in trying to kind of catalyze the network of interested artists in asking for or imagining a new arts council in Detroit that might represent some of their interests.
Do you think it would include some tax money support that way, or do you see this office as just creating an atmosphere that's conducive to artists and art?
Well, definitely resources are always a question, and where those resources come from is a question that needs to be decided at a civic level. There are lots of models that we can look to. So in some instances, arts councils are funded primarily through sales tax, for example, in the European model. Some are funded through other tax resources. Some are funded through foundations. I think Detroit will need to invent its own model for imagining sort of the most diverse, pluralistic, and civically minded version of an arts council that could benefit everyone.
I'm glad you mentioned foundations because there's a fair amount of support for arts projects from private foundations. I just covered several that Kresge is involved in. Why do you think the city needs to get involved in the mix since there is that kind of philanthropical support?
There is an incredible amount of philanthropic interest in Detroit, and it's coming from multiple sources. There are arts advocates at the Knight Arts Foundation, at Kresge, and a plethora of other foundations, including Art Place America and others. There's a sense that maybe that arts funding is finite. It's going to sort of run its course.
Right. Grants are always temporary.
Grants are temporary. We need to think about a sustainable model for envisioning a way to create a security net for all of that creative practice, which attracts so much attention to Detroit.
Let's talk about how the city is treating artists now. I mean, it's not been welcoming to certain groups of artists, such as graffiti artists. Charges were filed against graffiti artists, most notably the world-famous Shepherd Fairey. Even some businesses have been fined, ticketed, because of graffiti on their buildings. So it doesn't seem the city's all that open to some expressions. How do you get past something like that?
Well, I think that's a really good point, and one of the reasons why the Arts Council, or the idea of an Arts Council, is so important in Detroit, which is we need an advocacy group to express and explain to a broad audience what contemporary architecture and art practices and design practices look like, so that we can identify, you know, the difference between tagging something and creating an expressive work of art. Sometimes those are hard to identify.
Art is in the eye of the beholder.
Right, but we need to support those kinds of practices because they give such a unique identity and vibe to Detroit and a sense of place. So we need arts advocates to make a case and decriminalize some of this activity so that our murals and our artworks and our street art continues to be a cultural attractor.
You're proposing city government get involved in the arts community and support it at a time when the atmosphere in government is basically, and I'm not talking about Detroit, I'm talking about more broadly that, you know, it's not government's business to be supporting the arts. Government shouldn't be involved in picking winners or losers, whether it's business or art.
Of course, it's challenging. But in the history of American art, I think government has always been a critical part of the equation. Obviously, the market has been an incredible driver for arts practices in the U.S., but governance has always played a critical role in making a case in advocating for the arts in communities and for the arts in redevelopment. And I think, like, especially as Detroit redevelops, a city that's 83% African American, that has a very strong cultural identity, we need to make sure that the deeply rooted cultural activity is protected as the city changes.
What would be the first thing you'd want to see from a City of Detroit arts and culture entity?
The folks that are involved in the Detroit Culture Council, which is an informal organization with lots of different interests, might have very different answers to this question. From my perspective, I think that Detroit is ready to look forward and look outside of the bounds of its own metropolitan area and to sort of step on the international stage. I think it's time that we could think that Detroit could think about a kind of international biennale and to get involved in public discourse about arts, creativity, creative production with other cities globally and think about more broad issues rather than focusing entirely on itself.
What kind of overtures have you made to City Hall or to Mayor Duggan about this idea?
There's been a letter that's been issued to Mayor Duggan. We haven't received a response yet.
I was going to ask, did you get a response?
That's not just yet. Yes. But there's also a petition that you can sign. So there are ways that you can show support for this idea.
What do you do in the meantime?
In the meantime, we continue to have meetings and cultural programs and sort of uplift and illustrate the breadth of incredible creative activity that's happening in Detroit currently.
That's one thing that occurs to me. There is so much happening right now across the city in the neighborhoods. I mean, it's not like just an idea of a statue of RoboCop in downtown or something like that. There's a lot going on by citizens in the neighborhoods. what would an arts and culture office offer those folks?
Well, first of all, these projects are very difficult to locate for people who are new to the city or for people who are not familiar with the breadth of neighborhoods and the breadth of cultural activity that's currently happening. Having an office or a space where people could quickly get to know some of those critical projects and programs could unify the network of artists currently operating in Detroit. I think that kind of broadcast and visibility would be incredibly powerful. It would be a powerful tool for locally rooted redevelopment.
Anya Sirota is an assistant professor of architecture at the University of Michigan's Taubman School of Architecture. She and several other artists in Detroit think the city ought to create an Office of Arts and Culture to help develop the artists who are already there and bring it to the neighborhoods as well.
That's
Thanks
right.
very much for coming in.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. It's Wednesday. Time again to talk about our state's history. And stateside Cynthia Canty has you covered.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
If you've ever been in an elevator, a shopping mall, a waiting room, or been put on hold, you have likely experienced the work of Michigander Major General George Owen Squire. And if that name doesn't ring a bell, perhaps this does. That's right. The much-loved and hated background music known as Muzak hails from our state. Here now to talk Michigan history with us is Mark Harvey of the Michigan History Center. Mark, where is General George Owen Squire from?
He's from Dryden, Michigan, out in Lapeer County in the Thumb area. And he grew up there and then went off to West Point and graduated and then got a PhD at Johns Hopkins University and rose through the ranks during World War I to become the top Signal Corps officer for. He had quite the military career.
Some people, I'm one of them, might not think that Muzak would have come from such a person. How did George Squire get started down the path of creating Muzak?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much the opposite image of a career military officer. But he was creative. He was essentially the person responsible for creating the aeronautics division in the Army. He was the first military passenger in a plane. He bought the first airplane from the Wright brothers for the United States Army. So he was an innovator. He was also, you know, an experimenter, and he was intrigued with the idea of radio waves. He's part of the Signal Corps, so they're doing experimentation with how to better communicate among troops. So he's experimenting with radio waves and electricity. He actually co-invented the polarizing photo chronograph, which we know today as the radar gun. So the next time you get a speeding ticket, you can thank him for that.
So we have two things to thank him for.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
So he creates this way of delivering, transmitting music across electrical wires, but it took some time to work out the technical kinks, and by then it was the 1930s, and hello, we had the radio age. How did he compete with that?
Yeah, it's really an amazing thing to step back and think. He was transmitting music through regular household electrical wires right into the house. To me, that seems actually more amazing than the radio waves. But they came up with that first, tested it on Staten Island in New York, and then radio just got rolling and sort of wiped out their business plan. But instead of just folding up their tent, they pitched it to businesses as sort of this prepackaged set of music, because radio, even though it was popular with advertisers and a unique way to communicate, you could have signal problems depending on weather and other things. So this was a more, especially for businesses, they didn't want people listening to staticky transmissions of music. They wanted it to be solid. So they figured out that business plan and sold it to mostly to businesses as prepackaged music for their offices and businesses.
So here you go, stores and restaurants and office buildings. We've got music for you. Where did Muzak get its music from?
They hired the top-of-the-line studio musicians of the time. In fact, there was one excerpt where they were touting in their advertisement that they had the hottest harpist available. That really goes along with my concept of Muzak, though, right? The hottest harpist available. But they were session musicians, the same ones that you would probably find in Nashville now that are backing some of the biggest acts and names in music. But this paid, and it was a surging business, and they had cornered the market on it.
Wait, is it safe to say it really, really kind of evolved and took off in the 40s and 50s?
Yeah, and the name Muzak, I mean, I think we sort of use that as a pejorative term, but he liked the success in the name of Kodak so much that he just adapted that. He just tacked the ack onto the word, the name music. And so that's where that name comes from. And then in the 40s, they really stepped it up to a different level. During war production, they took that idea of music in the workplace as a means of productivity. And they came up with this concept of stimulus progression is what they called it. And this was lots of company-based research that they could increase war production by feeding music to the workers in 15-minute segments. Hmm. And they would feed it to them for 15 minutes at the beginning of the day, slower music, maybe that hot harpist at the beginning of the day. And then they would take a break for 15 minutes so they didn't have listener fatigue. And then they'd come back for another 15 minutes of Muzak. And the music would increase in speed as they went along in the day. And the thought was, per their research, that it would increase the speed of production as well. And it really caught on.
We're going to take a quick listen now to the stimulus progression Muzak that was said to boost employee productivity. Is it true that even the White House was wired for Muzak, Mark?
Yeah, so Eisenhower brought it into the West Wing. LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, actually had a franchise of the Muzak company because they franchised it early on. He had the franchise in Texas, and so he brought it in. They even were purported to use it during NASA training to calm the astronauts as they trained for the lunar missions.
We certainly know that Muzak became known as elevator music, and it has kind of... It has certainly gone to beyond classic elevator music. We've seen them dipping into very popular hits, reworking them in its inimitable style. Here's a few examples of that. Muzak seemed to be regarded with, shall we say, some disdain, and maybe that's an understatement, among baby boomers. In fact, am I right, during the 1980s, didn't another famous Michigander make an offer to buy the company just so he could shut it down?
Yes, our very own Ted Nugent tried to raise $10 million to just buy him out because he was just done with it. And I don't know if that's because they never used his music for Muzak or if he just really hated it. But his famous quote is, "Muzak's an evil force in today's society, causing people to lapse into uncontrollable fits of blandness." I think he was onto something.
I think maybe so. How is it doing today in the age of MP3s and online streaming services?
Interestingly, it's like the Muzak song that just won't end. It just keeps going. And they've gone through some different iterations and buyouts, but the brand Muzak is still alive and well today. They went through restructuring in 2009 where they talked about filing for bankruptcy, and then they were bought out by Mute Music. They still carry the Muzak brand, and they've really adapted with the times. They now license regular top 40 musicians and other genres of music, so they're not just doing the instrumentals, but they've updated their toolkit to meet the needs. So we just walked in the office here, and there was music piped in on the streets of Lansing, and we looked around and thought, wow, Muzak's right here now. It's in lots of towns and shopping centers still.
all because of General George Owen Squire of Dryden. Thank you so much. That's the Michigan History Center's Mark Harvey. Always great to have you stop by and share more Michigan history with us. And a tip of the hat to General Squire the next time we hear Muzak. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thanks, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. The U.S. Geological Survey reports since the turn of the last century, water levels of Lake Michigan have increased in a series of ever higher peaks. In 1964, an expensive house in St. Joseph was taken by the lake. There was damage up and down Michigan's coast that year. Another high lake water moment spanned from 1985 to 1987. And again, there was a lot of damage to homes, beachfront property, and industry. Researchers have been working with local communities to help determine the best ways to plan for those different lake levels, because they're coming. You can imagine the temptation of someone to build right next to a beach or on a bluff overlooking the lake during one of those low-level periods, just to see that house fall off of an eroding bluff or wake up and find lake water at your knees in your beach house. Joining me now is Dick Norton with the University of Michigan's Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning. You're working with other researchers and experts to understand the fluctuating lake levels and their impacts on the coast. Who all's involved?
I've been collaborating the longest with a colleague, Guy Meadows, who's up at Michigan Tech University. He was at U of M for quite a while, but he's now the director of the Great Lakes Research Lab up there. He really understands how lake levels affect shoreline dynamics and especially how the shape of the shorelines change over time as lake levels change over time. And it turns out that's quite different from the way ocean coast shorelines change. And it's kind of in a sneaky way. When the lake levels are low for a period of time, the lakes tend to push a lot of sand up onto the beach. And so you get this kind of double whammy false impression that the lakes have gone down, we've got lots of beach we can build. The problem is when the lake levels come back up, they can quickly chew away at that sand that's there and start cutting back into the shoreline. So Guy had that figured out a long time ago. I'm a planner and a lawyer by training, and so I'm very interested in the way that local governments take that information or not, as the case may be, and fold it into their local planning efforts. So we've been trying to figure out, along with the Land Information Access Association, it's a nonprofit planning firm located up in Traverse City. Our three groups have been collaborating with local communities to figure out how can we come up with methods that local governments can use that don't require really expensive engineering studies to better fold an understanding of the risks that their shoreline properties are at into their local planning efforts.
Now, longtime residents of the lakeshore understand that we have these fluctuations. I can imagine that there are city managers who haven't been around that long, or developers for that matter, who've not been around long enough to understand what they see today might be a lot different in 10 years or 15 years. Are cities along the coast making some bad zoning or development decisions right now?
We've done some work and collected community plans and evaluated this systematically, and it's pretty remarkable how few of them really are paying attention to their coastline. And in fact, I like to quip that you wouldn't know a lot of these communities are coastal communities except they have a picture of a lighthouse on the front cover. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I think they're relying on the state. They think the state's going to protect them. And the lakes have been so low for so long, up until just the last few years, there just wasn't a whole lot of oomph to worry about them. You're right that local residents are more aware of the way the lakes work, but that's not always good insurance. In fact, there was a house built in St. Joe really close to the water. When I first saw it, I thought, wow, they have to be a new resident. Turns out they've been lifelong residents. They just had thought, well, the lakes have gone down, we can build. So they built really close to the water, and they've since had to pick that house and move it back.
Wow.
Because of the lakes when they came back up.
You know, when I covered the environment regularly, I remember a lot of encouragement for cities to consider what's called softscape rather than hardscape along Great Lakes shorelines. Can you tell us what that means and why it makes a difference?
So hardscape, another term for that is armoring. So the idea is put out groins or breakwalls or hardened structures that
sure,
are
seawalls made of concrete
seawalls,
metal.
Exactly,
yeah, yeah.
Yep. Those work really well at protecting the house that's on the beach. They're really bad for the beach itself. The tendency, the pressure is once you've built a house and you see the lake now chewing away at your beach is to want to build a hardened structure to protect it. The problem is with the way the lakes work, that means the beach will eventually disappear. The lake will just scour away the sand. And especially when lakes come back up, you can see long stretches of beach where there's no beach left. It's all just armored structure. Softscape or green infrastructure or those approaches are attempts to use vegetation, a mix of rock and such that are designed to be more natural protective buffers to try and let the shoreline move as naturally as it can. And the key thing to know about the beach is it's a dynamic system. It's not going to stay in one place. It moves as the lakes change. So we're really trying to figure out how to get property owners to think about engaging softscape structures instead of hardened structures.
So you're working with these communities, and I can imagine some of them don't want to have restrictions because it might discourage developers or they'd be forced to deliver some bad news to some of the landowners in the area. So what are the consequences in that situation?
So, yeah, private property rights are alive and well in coastal Michigan communities. And there are a lot of good reasons to worry. You know, folks have spent a lot of money and invested a lot in their properties and want to enjoy them. The problem is if you don't try and regulate that somehow or encourage them to move back instead of harm's way, they really become at risk of being damaged, if not destroyed, when the right storm comes along. There's a lot of uncertainty here because we don't know when the lakes are going to – what level they're going to be at any given time.
Right. It's not regular.
It's not regular. And then factor on top of that increasing storminess that's coming on with climate change. Well, if you get the right storm with a high water level, you could see tremendous damage. At the other hand, if you get the right storm when the lakes are low, maybe the damage won't be so bad. So there's a lot of why do we need to worry about this? It's imposing on people. That, by the way, is the major stretch of their tax revenue because that's where really all the wealthy homes are tend to be, is right on the shoreline. So there's a lot of incentive for communities to kind of not pay attention to their shoreline, and they're really kind of shooting craps. If they do that, and they may luck out for decades with no bad storm, but one good storm could come and do a whole lot of damage and undermine all of that.
You mentioned climate change. It's one of the questions I wanted to ask you about. We see different models showing different impacts on the Great Lakes. How do you deal with climate change and the uncertainty when you make your recommendations?
So we've been working on a method called scenario-based planning, which is to kind of envision different what we call climate futures, a lucky future, an expected future, and a perfect storm future. And it's combinations of where lake levels might be at any given time with increasing storminess. There is a lot of uncertainty here, and I know climate change is a controversial concept. It turns out if you get away from that term and all of the baggage that it brings and just talk about the variability of the lakes over time, local residents know that. They've experienced the lakes coming up and down, and they're seeing increased storminess. So they recognize they need to deal with the uncertainty and the conditions they're confronting. And then the trick is how to just trade off. How much do we need to invest in setbacks, new green infrastructure, stormwater management systems, so that we can kind of be better prepared and more resilient, if you will, from these future storms? And what's the most logical way to do that, given the likelihood that those storms will hit, recognizing there's still a whole lot of uncertainty about what might hit and when it would happen?
One of the other things I wanted to ask you about is if you put development in the wrong place, it can have an impact on the environment. And, you know, the shores tend to be a really important place for fish hatcheries and things like that. How do you explain that part to people that, you know, if you put your house or your wall here, all of this behind it is going to be impacted because it's not getting the kind of environment it needs to thrive?
A picture's worth a thousand words. We do have photographic evidence of homes that have been lost to the lake. That can strike one's imagination. The house that was built in St. Joseph that I mentioned has become kind of the poster child of, if you're not careful with where you build, you can end up with having houses that are way too far out. And what happened with that house was the lakes came back up, and we have good aerial imagery of that house at greater risk as the lake was getting closer and closer. That's a good way to do it. The state and NOAA has developed coastal viewers that allow you to try and guesstimate where the shoreline will be as water levels change. A lot of imagery to show wetlands and how they exist, where they are, how they are situated in terms of hazard zones. Those kinds of maps are useful tools to get folks to think about what they're confronting.
We're going to talk to the community development manager for Grand Haven after we finish here. You've worked with Grand Haven. That's one city. What kind of special challenges did you find there?
We worked both with the city and the township of Grand Haven, and they did a collaborative planning effort together, and then we worked with each of them to go a little bit further and make suggestions on how they might modify their zoning codes. And the problems that they present are the same that we see elsewhere, which is a lack of salience. We just haven't had problems like this in the in the past that we can remember, so why worry about it now?
Yeah, because it's been 30 years.
It's been 30 years, yeah. There's a lot of development that's now created pressure to not want to pay attention to this too much. While the stretch of the coast is really important to these communities, there's still – that's just a thin slice of the larger community. So they're pretty overwhelmed with all of the other stuff that communities are having to deal with nowadays. So there's just a whole lot of inertia to not really pay attention to this. It really takes proactive community leaders, like the community development leader that you'll talk to, was really interested in working with us to try and pay attention to these issues. And the timing was right because the community was at a place where it needed to update its master plan anyway. So it made a lot of sense to try and do a better job of folding these coastal issues into their ongoing plan update efforts.
Well, we'll talk with them in a second, but I want to thank you for coming in. Dick Norton is Urban and Regional Planning Professor with the University of Michigan's Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Now let's turn to Jennifer Howland, who is the Community Development Manager for Grand Haven. You've been updating your master plan. What kind of help were these guys? What kind of the material that they put together?
Oh, it was immensely helpful. We were in need of an update to our master plan, and when they reached out to us to consider looking at our community through the lens of resiliency, we were really intrigued. Being a community right on the lakeshore, we are impacted by water level changes and different weather events that impact the properties immediately adjacent to our waterways. So we thought that it was a really unique way to look at master planning.
Now, the lakes haven't been high for a while, in fact, almost 30 years when they hit their high water mark. Has Grand Haven been guilty of allowing builders to get too close to the lake?
No, the city's been pretty proactive with making sure that we recognize that the water levels do fluctuate over time. It has been quite some time since they have been high, and sometimes memories are short, but along the water line, we do have average setback requirements in certain areas that protect view sheds as well as keeping people from getting too close to the water.
How did the discussions in Grand Haven go among the politicians and among the staff at City Hall and at the township? How'd they go regarding repercussions of limits on development along Lake Michigan?
Well, everyone was really interested in understanding how far the regulations might go. I think everyone was pretty much on board with the idea that it's important to have development appropriately located and built in a way that's not going to be damaged by high water. We recognize that. But the idea of having too many regulations was also a sensitive topic. But through the planning part of it, we were able to think broadly, and generally the community accepted the ideas of being mindful of how development impacts the natural water fluctuations, as well as how we can protect our investments in our property development.
Give me an example of a specific change that Grand Haven will make because of this research.
Well, we're considering some changes. We didn't commit to any legislative changes at this time. The master plan has been adopted, so we do have a policy guide that has specific chapters about how to have proper development placement and consideration for natural features of the environment. But in terms of changing our laws, that's in the future. We're looking at potentially modifying some setback requirements in one of the lakeshore neighborhoods to make sure that it's not just an average setback, but perhaps considering a larger minimum waterfront setback. So there would be no chance for them to get too close and cause their property to be in jeopardy.
Seems to make sense, but of course, if you've got that beach house, you want to get it as close to the lake as possible, I guess.
Yes, that's true.
Are the neighbors going to understand what you're trying to do?
Well, we already have regulations that protect their views, so nobody can go further out towards the lake than their neighbors on the either side. But over time, you could imagine as properties redevelop, that average can scoot closer and closer to the lake. So we're thinking at some point it may be practical to have a hard line where in no instance can you go closer than that certain distance.
A little housing building creep that there sounds like. That's Jennifer Howland. She's the community developer manager for Grand Haven. They just redid their master plan with the help of some researchers to make sure that when the lake rises again, their buildings and property won't be in danger. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Lake Michigan is a giant time capsule. It swallows stuff up and spits it back out somewhere down the line, both in time and place.
A message in a bottle washed up in the stateside offices. It's from our old friend and former colleague, Tamar Charney.
All sorts of things get pushed up on the beach by waves in summer and by the freezing and thawing of ice in the winter. When the snow melts in spring, there aren't that many people combing through the odds and ends in search of lost treasure or even just cleaning up the trash. That means it's easier to see how Lake Michigan is its own special sort of time capsule, coughing up treasures up and down the shore. There are the things you expect. There are the pieces of charcoal from someone's beach campfire last summer. Usually, there's at least one dead balloon that some kid in Chicago must have lost hold of. And it isn't at all uncommon to kick a bleached beer can that fell overboard from some fishing boat. And then there are often these surreal mashups of the natural and the man-made, like that blue pen cap nestled up in some seaweed and fish bones. But every once in a while, the lake returns some unexpected reminder of the past. This time, it was a French 5-franc coin. The sand and waves had worn down the goddess of liberty, Marianne, on the headside. The leaves on the other side didn't look so great either. But Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité was easily readable, as was the date on the coin, 1978. This coin was almost 40 years old. Who knows how long it had been tossed around in the lake before being spit out onto the sand at my feet. Francs had been out of circulation for over a decade. Yet somehow, it seemed fitting to me that a franc would turn up on the same beach known for Petoskey stones. Petoskey stones are the most notable of Lake Michigan's little time capsules. These are rocks that look just like another smooth stone until they get wet. That's when you can see the outlines of ancient fossilized coral. The namesake of both Petoskey stones and this beach is an Odawa chief, Chief Petosiga, who purchased land in this area after the Treaty of Washington. While his mother was Odawa, his father was a French fur trader. It's a typical story. The founding of this state is a tale of battles, alliances, and relationships between the tribes and the French traders. Fur was the economic currency of those settlement days. And my little French coin is its own time capsule reminder of another currency that is no more. And that's the thing about this lake. It's full of reminders of things past. Humans have vastly altered the land on the other side of the dunes. There are ski resorts and golf courses there. There are highways and fracking wells. But here along the lake, it looks as if so little has changed. This is pretty much the same coastline Chief Petosiga laid eyes on. It's what vacationers from Chicago saw from the decks of passenger steamers in the early 1900s. That means Lake Michigan has this way of conjuring up days gone by, particularly when things wash up that invite you back into the past, to wonder about what happened here last week, last century, and last millennia.
Tamar Charney is the managing editor of NPR One. She writes from Michigan about all sorts of things, including her love affair with Lake Michigan. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth, who scrambled for your show today. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Nick Wallace, and Lise Messmer. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty, thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.